Thanks very much, Aaron. It's a great honor and privilege for me to be here this afternoon. I have many friends here at the University of Toronto, so it's wonderful to see them again. Also, it's fantastic to be at this storied physics department. I'm from Cornell University. I want to talk to you this afternoon about new departures in the field of visualizing quantum matter, electronic quantum matter, at the atomic scale. These are ideas and tools that have been developed now over the last 5 or 6 years. So my work is with my colleagues at Cornell, and especially with Uchida-sensei at Tokyo University and Tagaki-sensei at Tokyo and Riken. We use very specially designed samples to carry out the experiments that I'm going to tell you about. Two other key people are Hiroshi Esaki at East, and Kyle McElroy, who was a student of mine. He's now on the faculty at Boulder. So first, let me just make a comment about complex electronic matter. What should you think about? The easiest thing to think about is start with a monatomic ideal gas. It has very few properties. Then make the interactions more and more complex and strong. It'll turn into a liquid. The liquid is more complex. It's still a relatively simple system. Now make the interactions even stronger and then make them shape-dependent, orientation-dependent. You'll end up with liquid crystals of all different strange types. So we're familiar with those ideas because they play a large role in our technology. But there's no reason why the free electron gas in a piece of copper, when the interactions become stronger and stronger in a different material, it turns into a strongly coupled fluid, a Fermi fluid. And then when they become even more complex and stronger, it can turn into an electronic liquid crystal of all different types. So that's what I'd like you to think about when I'm talking about complex electronic quantum matter. Now, the particular case that I work on are the transition metal oxides and perovskite crystal structures. These perovskites are very simple. You have a cage of six oxygen atoms surrounding one of these transition metal atoms, titanium, vanadium, chromium, manganese, iron, cobalt, nickel, or copper. It seems like an extraordinarily simple system, but this system has yielded some of the most astonishing discoveries in the last 15 or 20 years in the physics of electronic materials. If you put a manganese atom at this site, you get material which has colossal magnetoresistance. The resistance changes by many, many orders of magnitude as a function of magnetic field. For next generation reed heads, this is actually very important, the ability to have more resistive sensitivity to magnetic field. If you put a cobalt atom here, you get material with giant thermopower. Thermopower like the liquids we use in your refrigerator at home. But here, the liquid being used is just the strongly interacting electrons in the crystal. So rather soon, in fact, it's already happening, you'll be able to buy commercial electronic refrigerators of more and more power because of systems like this. If you put a nickel atom here, you do get a genuine electronic crystal. It's called a stripe. I don't have time to discuss it today. And if you put a copper atom here, I have a movie of something floating due to high TC, but it's not working right now. If you put a copper atom here, you get high-temperature superconductivity. That is lossless transport lossless electric and electronic technology would be the long-term outcome from having high TC superconductivity. They all come from this rather simple-looking thing, but they have very, very strange and complex properties. The phenomena in these systems emerge from states, from electronic states, which were localized on the atoms before whatever chemical doping process was carried out. So they all emerge from an insulator. And they exhibit intense spin, charge, and lattice interactions, many orders of magnitude stronger than go on in the almost free electron gas in simple metals and semiconductors. And they have very strong correlations and nanoscale self-organization of the electronic structure. And our working hypothesis is that to fully understand these phenomena, we need to know what happens to the electronic structure at the atomic scale. So to do that, we use spectroscopic imaging, STM. So an STM is a rather conceptually simple device. You scan a sharp tip back and forth over the surface. It's a few angstroms away. You apply a voltage between the tip and the sample. You get a tunnel current, measure the tunnel current, and feedback so the tip rasters without touching the surface. So using that type of technology, you can take a very nice picture of where the atoms are in the surface. Each one of these dots here is a selenium atom in a small field of view in a niobium diselenide crystal. But seeing the atoms really is only a tiny step along the route we need to take. If the electrons are no longer governed by the locations of the atoms, you've got to see where the electrons are. So can we see the electronic wave functions? That's the question. Now, in principle, there's a way of doing that. Here's the STM tip. Here's the sample. Suppose the tip is a piece of metal with a density of states as a function of energy, which is flat. And at low temperature, the states are filled up to the Fermi energy of the tip. Now, here's the sample you want to study. It has some strange density of states, but it's metallic, so the states are filled up to the Fermi energy. And when the potential difference between these two objects is zero, the two Fermi energies are equalized. Now, if we turn on a bias here, we raise the Fermi level of the tip. And in doing so, these empty states here become available for elastic tunneling. So the tunnel current that goes from the tip to the sample is the is the integral over the density of states in the sample from the Fermi energy to an energy set by the bias voltage. And so if I modulate the bias voltage by a small amount, dV, I'll produce a modulating current of amplitude dI. And dI is the density of states in the sample multiplied by dV. So dI dV, the differential conductance, is proportional to the local density of states at an energy controlled by the battery. If you measure dI dV as a function of V, you're measuring the density of electronic states as a function of energy. That's our main observable. Now, why is that useful? Well, suppose you have a crystal surface. There's about 50,000 atoms individually resolved here, but the projector doesn't have enough pixels for me to show them to you. But we can zoom in. Each one of those is a bismuth atom. You park the STM tip at one of those atoms, let's say this one, and measure dI dV as a function of V. You get some function. That's the density of electronic states at that location. Now you'd like to map it everywhere. So the objective is to measure the differential conductance basically at every single atom in this field of view. You can do that. I'll show you how in a second. And at the end of that process, you know the differential conductance value at a given energy, let's say minus 100 millivolts, and you know it everywhere in the field of view. This is the differential conductance in this field of view at that energy. But you can know it at every energy. If we follow the trace down here in energy, looking at the density of states of electronic states in space. Some energies, for example, this energy here, it's intensely heterogeneous on the few nanometer scale. This is 600 angstroms, so that's about 30 angstroms. And then at other energies, it becomes quite homogeneous until sometimes you can see that's an impurity atom, which is producing a scattering resonance. So at the end of the day, you can measure an atomic resolution, energy-resolved image of the local density of states as a function of position and energy. And within some simple models, you can think of that as an image of the wave function of the electrons. You're imaging up psi squared of the electrons everywhere and as a function of energy. It's a complete map of the electronic structure. Now, how come you don't see these machines parked in every hallway in universities? There are very big technical challenges to doing this. Suppose you want to take 512 by 512 pixels, that's 250,000 pixels, and then each pixel you take 200 values of differential conductance. So that's 50 million conductance measurements. If you want to make 50 million of any measurement in 24 hours, you have about 2 milliseconds per measurement, and we want to maintain the signal-to-noise at about 100. So when you do all the engineering calculations, you find out we have to stabilize the STM tip in space so that it does not move relative to the sample within about 1 femtometer. It's not to give more spatial resolution. There is no more spatial resolution available. The size of the atom is fixed. It's to give enough signal to noise to completely map the electronic structure in a finite time. Now, to do that, there is a concrete solution. So here's a former A corridor of Clark Hall in Cornell. My colleagues are over here on the right, and they didn't wish to partake in this project. So in order to do the construction, and this is the outside ground level, we had to dig down on the outside and then cut a wall, a hole in the underground wall, like tomb robbers, and then come inside and dig down another story. So we dug out a two-story-high underground tunnel. So into that tunnel, we put a barrier. This is a termination for the rest of the building floor. It's 5,000 tons of concrete. It's so that if somebody drops a screwdriver on the floor elsewhere in the building and sends a 1 angstrom amplitude acoustic wave to our lab, this is an impedance mismatcher, which just sends the wave right back again. So we have a separate foundation in here for our lab. So into one of these spaces here, we put an underground 6-meter concrete vault with acoustic isolation. And then into that space, we put a 30-ton concrete block, which is the floor, on vibration isolators. And on that block, we put an internal acoustic room, an acoustic shield room. And into the inner room, we put an ultra-low vibration table. This table is mostly made of lead shot. It's about 5 tons of lead shot. And then there's another layer of vibration isolation here. And then here's our container. In the container, there's liquid helium 4, vacuum space. Here's the STM. We put the sample down, cleave, and put it into the STM. Here's a picture of the STM itself. So we use sub-Kelvin temperatures usually, high field STM, and we can exchange samples from room temperatures about every 6 hours. So when we do that, here's a picture of the location of the bismuth atoms on a particular surface in one of these machines. And as the dean at Cornell is wont to say to me, you could take that picture for about $10,000, so why did you need all the money? So the reason is that this picture doesn't give you the information you want. You want to know what the wave functions of the electrons look like in this field of view, and here's what they look like. We can map them completely now with subatomic resolution. It takes us about 12 hours per map. So this converted a rather scary challenge into what is now a very practical tool. You have a new material, you put it in the machine, you measure where all the wave functions are. The next morning, you know the answer. Okay, now let's turn to the objective of this tool. High-TC superconductivity is what I'm going to talk about. These materials start out as ionic crystals, strongly insulating. Here's the copper atom, here's the oxygen atom surrounding. If you substitute an electronegative atom on the lanthanum site, a foreign electron attracting atom, then it converts the system into a high-TC superconductor. This is the 20th anniversary of the discovery of high-TC, and we know a tremendous amount. We don't know what the mechanism is, but we know basically everything else. There's about 25 families. Undoped, they're all ionic insulators. Chemically doped, they're all high-TC superconductors. They have a single structural and electronic feature in common. It's a copper-oxygen plane. And these materials have enormous economic and scientific potential, especially if we could reach room temperature superconductivity. Already, they're economically viable. They're used in high-field magnets. They're used in cell phone filters. They're used in silent ship and submarine propulsion. You won't find much about this on the web, but if you look in the defense budgets of various countries, you'll find out a lot of money is going into superconducting motors. They're just very quiet about it. And now it's becoming very important in power grid stabilization. So in the future, people imagine that we could have lossless transmission. This is pretty doubtful in my opinion, but some people put this forward. A big focus in Japan is that we could have ultra-high-speed computers because the RC time would go to zero. You would be limited by the speed of light in your laptop, not by RC, because there would be no resistivity. Okay, so here's the challenge. You take a material, square lattice, copper, oxygen, copper, oxygen, copper, oxygen, copper. The coppers and the oxygens actually become ionized, copper 2+, oxygen 2-. So the copper atom goes into a 3D9 state with a single spin a half electron, and the oxygen atom just is in a closed 2P6 state, closed shell state. The 3D9 orbital in the crystal fields here has a dx squared minus y squared symmetry, and there's a single electron in each one of these orbitals. So in the simplest possible picture, it's a square lattice with a spin a half electron at each vertex. That's one electron per orbital, so by band theory it should be a metal, but it's not. It's an antiferromagnetic insulator. And the reason is that the energy for one electron to doubly occupy the next site is about 8 electron volts. And at room temperature, it's just not available. It's impossible. Also, we know why it's antiferromagnetic. There's a second order exchange process which aligns the spins in this fashion. Now, when we dope this material, we remove some of the electrons from this plane. Immediately, transport becomes possible because there are hole states into which the electrons can jump, and many new phases, including high TC superconductivity, appear. So here's a phase diagram. Here's the insulator. This is the axis, the number of holes per CuO2 plaquette. This is temperature. Here's the antiferromagnetic insulator. Here's a mysterious phase. Here's the D-wave superconductor, and over here there's a somewhat metallic phase. There are far, far too many things for me to talk about in this phase diagram today. So I'm just going to focus on the electronic structure of the D-wave superconducting state, its disorder, and the electron-boson interactions in here. Tomorrow I'm going to talk a little bit about new discoveries about this unknown state down here. Okay, now there's a very long history of using tunneling spectroscopy to study superconductivity. Here's the picture. You start with a metal. The low energy, long de Broglie wavelength states are all filled up to the Fermi energy. At low temperatures, electrons of opposite momentum and opposite spin interact with each other through an exchange boson. And in this case, it's a lattice vibration mode. So this electron sends out a virtual phonon. This one scatters off it, and by that process, a pair, a bound pair, is formed, called a Cooper pair. So this metal converts itself into a new state. You can think of it as a gas of these pairs. There's an energy gap to break each pair. That's called the energy gap delta. And this process is phonon-mediated. It's done by exchange of phonons in conventional superconductors. Now, we know what the ground state is very, very well. It's the BCS ground state. This is the 50th anniversary of of BCS. And we also know what the excited states are. It's the 49th anniversary of the excited states. The Hamiltonian was diagonalized by Bogdanov. And these are, above the energy gap, there are electron-like states, and below the energy gap, there are hole-like states. You can think of them approximately as free electrons or free holes. Now, the reason why I focus on that is that these excited states are measurable by tunneling spectroscopy. You can measure the density of states as a function of energy. And when you do so, you see exactly what is predicted by theory. There are no states inside the superconducting energy gap. And then outside that gap, there's a big peak in the states, and then it goes back to normal. That's what the spectrum of excited states should look like. Here's Javer. He received the Nobel Prize for showing that normal insulator superconductor tunneling, if you measure DIDV versus V, shows the gap in the density of states very clearly. Here's delta, the energy gap. Here's the peak. It's called the coherence peak. So that was a fabulously beautiful experiment. In his first paper, he didn't mention these two wiggles down here. They're also tremendously important because they are steps in the differential conductance. And it was subsequently realized from theory that those steps are due to the electron-phonon interaction, which is gluing the electrons together. They occur, if there's a phonon of energy omega, then a step should occur in the density of states at absolute energy delta plus omega. Here, there are two phonons. So the great beauty of tunneling spectroscopy is you can see the energy gap. You can see the phonon energy or the boson energy, and you can even determine the pairing mechanism. If Javer hadn't got the Nobel Prize for seeing this feature, it's quite conceivable that he could have got it for seeing the other feature in the same spectrum. Now let's turn to Biscoe. Here's the unit cell. I'll come back to that in a second. The band structure of this material when doped is very simple. Here's the first Brillouin zone. Here are the filled low energy states in momentum space. Here's the Fermi energy, the termination point in line in momentum space. There are empty states here and filled states here. You can describe this by a tight binding band structure that you learn about as an undergraduate. Now, in the superconducting state, along this Fermi surface, a gap opens in the density of states. It's a superconducting energy gap, the energy gap to break the pairs. Except here, it's not isotropic in momentum space. In some regions here, it's very large, and in other regions here, it's zero. So the gap for going north and south is a maximum, but the gap for going northeast and southwest is zero, etc. So this is a D-like energy gap, superconducting energy gap, with four nodes and four maxima in momentum space. In fact, we know from phase-sensitive experiments that it is a D-symmetry order parameter. It changes sign every 90 degrees in momentum space. This gap rearranges the electronic structure of the superconducting state so that there are only four excitations at zero energy. Those are the Fermi points. And then at any finite energy, the excitations are on one of these bananas, they're called. Those are the contours of constant energy for the excited states. We'll come back to this. So here's our material. We break this crystal in our STM, and we see the bismuth oxide surface in the top layer. And underneath each bismuth atom, about 5 angstroms down, is the copper atom of the CuO2 plane. Here's copper. And there's 4 oxygens around it. There's an oxygen above, and then there's a bismuth above that. If we do a conventional STM picture, we see a pretty complicated structure. This is 560 angstroms. If we zoom in a little bit, each dot here is a bismuth atom. The corrugation you see is a real static corrugation of this surface. The unit cell dimension for bismuth oxide and CuO2 are different, so to put them together, the surface corrugates. But also this blobby stuff, which when we first developed this machine, we were the first people to see it. We thought it was a technical mistake, but it's not. It's a genuine form of electronic disorder. If we zoom in even further, each one of these four plaquettes, each one of these four sites are the sites of 4 bismuth atoms, but they're directly above the sites of 4 copper atoms in the CuO2 plane. Now, let's take the spectrum at one of those atoms, and here's what it looks like. Differential conductance as a function of bias. Does that make sense for a D-wave superconductor? Well, the answer is yes. If you write down a D-wave BCS simple superconductor and calculate the density of states, it should look like this. It has this shape because there are nodes. At zero energy, there are some states which exists down to zero energy. Here they are in the experiment. And then there are maxima in the gap. They exist at delta away from zero. Here they are. This typical spectrum is quite consistent with a nodal D-wave superconductor. That's nice. We're studying the state we want to study. It does, however, have these two other features out here, which are very strong and wouldn't be there in a simple model. We'll come back to those. They're a pair of strong particle hole symmetric features at energy bigger than the pair energy delta. By the way, please stop me and ask questions if you wish. Okay, so now let's turn to a really detailed experiment. Yeah? If the P wave had a line of nodes, that's correct. You have to use a phase-sensitive experiment to know that it's D wave. Right. So P wave line of KX plus IKY would have the same. Okay. So now let's map the density of states on this surface right here. We'll map it here with atomic subatomic resolution. Let's go down in energy. There's some action here. But then when we get to these energies, which you now know to be the coherence peaks of the D-wave superconductor, it's intensely disordered on the 3-nanometer scale. Really very vivid disorder. Then when you go down inside towards the node, it becomes electronically homogeneous very fast. And when you get to the Fermi energy, you will see a small number of impurity atoms. So that's and then we can map the empty state, something that other techniques can't do, seeing all the same things happening on the empty side. This already is consistent with D-wave VCS. So there are three regimes here. There's the low energy regime near the nodes. In momentum space, it's here as energy goes to zero. Then there's the higher energy regime near the antinodes. And in momentum space, it's here near the zone phase. And then there's the higher energy regime here, which can't really be represented in momentum space. I'm going to discuss those three regimes. So the first one is the near nodal states. This was the thesis work of Kyle McAvoy. Okay, so we're going to study what happens down here. So here's another one of these topographic images. You're looking at the bismuth atoms. Now let's look at the electronic wave functions at a particular low energy in this field of view. They look like that. They're not particularly impressive. There's some wiggles. There's some bumps. Maybe there's a little bit of order there that you might see. One way to examine something like this is to take the Fourier transform of exactly the same data set. So these are the atomic locations in the reciprocal space. And you see in here, there is some structure. There are some rather poorly coherent patterns in the electronic structure. Yeah?
Can I ask a question about these, like the thing on the left?
Yeah.
So this is a given experiment. Now, what if you do the experiment an hour later at the same energy on the same sample?
Yeah.
You get the same...
Can I exaggerate my answer?
Sure.
So the longest we've ever done, it is 9 months later, and there's no detectable change. Okay, so now let's take a look at this as a function of energy. As we go down in energy, these patterns are changing, but you see more and more order in the Fourier transform. There we are at the Fermi energy. Let's go back up. Let's go back down. So the wavelengths are all changing continuously with energy, and also the pattern is changing in some very interesting ways. So what's going on here? Well, this was, and the answer to this question was given by Donghai Li, my colleague, based on work by Eigler. If you have metallic states and you have impurities, at each impurity atom there's a little standing wave, a Friedel oscillation. So in the case of Eigler, he could have all the scattering impurities and put them in a place where he would make the standing waves coherent. This is the IDV imaging, and you see that there's oscillations in the density of states. They're dominated by a Q vector, which is twice the Fermi wave vector for this material. Now, in the case of the cuprates, how do we analyze that type of idea? Well, here's the electronic structure. At any given energy, the available states are on one of these bananas. So at 40 millivolts, they're on the outer banana here. Now, if you calculate the density of states from that contour of constant energy, you'll find out that the states here at the tips of the bananas have enormously higher density of states. It's because 1 over gradient Ke is very, very large as you approach the zone phase. So these octet of K-space locations dominate the scattering processes. If an electron with this wave vector scatters into that wave vector, this one scattering to that one, it produces an interference pattern. Simple. The Q vector of the interference pattern is the difference in the wave vectors of the two waves that scatter. That isn't even quantum mechanics. That's just wave interference. But we can see this Q vector because we see this modulation in the real space. We can measure that Q by taking the Fourier transform of the real space image of the wave functions. Now, if there are 8 locations at a given energy, you can write down all the possible scattering vectors, and here they are for that energy. But because the band structure is a function of energy, the lengths of the wave vectors and their direction should be different at different energies. I'm just showing you all the solutions for a sequence of different energies. And indeed, if you look at this pattern here, you'll see that it's in excellent agreement with the structure that's expected for these wave vectors. Startlingly good agreement, actually. And even the dispersion of those interference patterns is in very good agreement with that model. So what we're seeing here is the wavelengths of different states as they scatter off some source of disorder in the material. We can use Deng Haili's model of these eight scattering sources to find, just from this data, where did the scattering come from in momentum space, and it's in excellent agreement with the photo emission determination of where the Fermi energy is. And we can even measure the gap, the momentum space gap in the density of states from real space data. This really surprised me, but it works just fine. It's really nice. Okay, so we didn't really discover anything new in that in the section I've just gone over, although it is really beautiful and interesting, except that there's a great deal of scattering interference of the D-wave quasiparticles, and we should ask ourselves, what is causing all this scattering? Okay, now let's talk about disorder, nanoscale electronic disorder. Now we're going to focus on the energies near the superconducting energy gap maximum, somewhere near 50 millivolts. So that's 60. So here we come up the outside of the coherence peak. This is near the maximum. So just in the raw data, the electronic structure is horribly disordered at these energies. So what we can do is take every spectrum, take the distance between these two peaks in energy and call it twice the pair energy, and then make a map of the energy which is gluing the pair together as a function of location. And it looks like this. It's horribly disordered on the 3-nanometer scale. This was such a surprise that it took almost 3 years to get the first paper published. It was known to be wrong. But now 12 groups around the world have repeated this experiment. It is correct. This is the environment in which the superconductivity survives. What's really happening is the detailed shapes of the spectra. Here's one of these maps of the superconducting energy gap. Let's say if we go from this region here, the spectra looks like this. If we go in here, they look like this. If we go in here, they look like this. And this happens all over the sample. Radical changes in the electronic structure from nanometer to nanometer. Okay, now we can study this throughout the whole phase diagram. This is a map of the energy gap up here at high doping. You can see here the color scale spans gap energies from red 10 millivolts to black 70 millivolts. All the gap energies here are disordered but around 12 millivolts. Here disordered but around 20-something millivolts. Here they're disordered and they're near 38 millivolts. Here they're horribly disordered and they're near 45, etc., etc. The disorder is always there at all dopings. That's my point. Evolving from overdoped to underdoped. Now, we know in detail what's happening. There's a class of spectra that can exist. And the probability, let's say, of this red spectrum existing here is like 90%, and here it's zero. The probability of this black spectrum existing here is zero, and here it's like 90%. You're just redistributing these different electronic, the density of these different electronic states. And one other thing I can say is we evolved from a very nice D-wave superconducting spectrum to a completely different spectrum at low doping. And this is what I'm going to discuss tomorrow, the state that is represented by that spectrum. But now let's turn to the burning question, which took Mr. McElroy about 4 years to answer. What is the source of all the electronic disorder in these materials? Well, could it be impurity atoms? Maybe our colleagues in Tokyo didn't do precisely as they said, and maybe there are a lot of impurity atoms in the crystal. We can examine that because we already have a botany of what different impurity atoms do to the electronic structure. This is a sample where 0.2% of zinc atoms were substituted at the copper site. There's about 60,000 bismuth atoms in this field of view, and there's about 20 zinc atoms. So here you see the power of spectroscopic STM. With a conventional STM, you don't have a snowball's chance in hell to find the 20 zinc atoms in this field of view. But if you know the energy of a local state, an impurity state at the zinc atom, you can just image the IDV at that energy, and you'll see where they are. And indeed, that's where they are. In this field of view, that's where the impurity atoms are. At each one of these impurity atoms, there's a beautiful D-symmetry impurity state. Good question. We'll come back to that next. Excellent question. So here's another example. Nickel atoms, there's 30 nickel atoms. We can find them easily. We can see the wave function of each impurity state. So back to the disorder. Did this sample here have hundreds of impurity atoms? Well, no, it didn't. It had only 7. We know exactly where they are. There's no way that these 7 impurity atoms could do this, at least in any rational world. There's no way that they could do it. And our Japanese colleagues were as good as their word. They said it was less than 100 parts per million, and it was. Okay. So what other population of foreign atoms exist in the crystal? That's what this question is about. It's the dopant atoms. In this material, when the dopants are put in, when the crystal is being formed, they diffuse in. These are oxygen atoms. They diffuse into the top layer, and they stay somewhere underneath this layer. And one can conjecture that each dopant atom damages the superconductivity nearby, and there are lots of them. This conjecture has been around since 1986. Gorkov. Immediately after ITC, Gorkov wrote a paper saying this is going to happen. However, it was not possible to test this hypothesis for the intervening 20 years because you need a technique which simultaneously knows where the dopant atoms were and knows what the electronic disorder looks like. And your traditional scattering techniques just don't have that capability. So we needed to find where are the dopant atoms. Each dopant atom is in a state minus 2e. It has captured 2 electrons. So they have additional states somewhere below the Fermi energy. So here's the density of states as a function of energy. Now in a big part of the band from minus 1 volt to plus 1 volt. Here's the superconductivity. And we were searching, Mr. McElroy was searching down here for the signature of the dopant atom, and I wouldn't be telling you this story if he didn't find it. There's a big, giant peak in the density of states at minus 0.96 volts. And the rest of it is only modestly perturbed. So if I take this as my energy at which I want to image the electronic structure, now I go back to another crystal. Here are the bismuth atoms. If I image at minus 0.96 volts, I see where the dopant atoms are. And you're right, there are lots of them. Now, how do we know they're the dopant atoms? Well, we did a sequence, Kyle McElroy did a sequence of studies where he changed the dopant density chemically, or our Japanese colleagues changed the dopant density, and then he counted the number of impurity atoms and showed that this state scales with the density of dopant atoms. So you have good a priori reason to believe. They're at the right energy, they have the right density, they change with doping. They're either the dopant atoms or they're an impurity state which is produced by the presence of the dopant atom. Okay, but do they cause the gap disorder? Here's an image of that superconducting gap disorder varying from around 20 millivolts all the way up to almost 70 millivolts. So in this field of view, you can map where the dopant atoms are, write down the coordinates, go back to your superconducting energy gap, overlay the coordinates of the dopant atoms, and now ask yourself, did those dopant atoms produce that disorder?
No.
Who's the naysayer? Okay. Is there anyone who thinks they could have produced it? Okay. Are there any TEM or STEM people in the audience? No, I could have guessed that. Okay, watch this. Okay. So look at all these regions with low gap. The probability of finding a dopant atom there is extremely low. Look at all these regions with these very high gaps. The probability of finding a dopant atom there is very high. Actually, the normalized correlation is about 35%, which for a point map and a continuous map is a very high correlation. They're well correlated. Wherever there's a cluster of dopant atoms, it does something bad to the electronic structure. We actually know what it is. If we go to an image of the density of states and consider a cluster, consider a region where there are few or no dopant atoms, then we see a nice D-wave superconducting spectrum. Consider a region where there's a cluster of dopant atoms, then we see a spectrum like this one, where all the D-wave superconducting spectral weight has been pushed out to high energies. and these coherence peaks have been suppressed, and all that's left is this little piece at the bottom. This is actually an extremely interesting piece of physics. Because, as you know, in traditional superconductivity, the impurity atom would do diametrically the opposite thing. So the two important conclusions here are that the same dopant atoms that capture the electrons and make the high TC superconductivity damage it at the atomic scale. From the material science point of view, this is an important conclusion. Secondly, the damage mechanism implies that the pairing is controlled by some very high energy scale, not by the low energies. Okay. So in my last 10 minutes, I want to talk about electron-boson interactions. And this is really code for talking about the mechanism of high TC. But in Canada, I can say that, but there are other places where I can't say that. This is Jin-Ho Lee, who is responsible for these beautiful experiments. So here we go. In conventional superconductors, the electron is coupled to the other electron of opposite spin and momentum. This is a space-time Feynman diagram, by the exchange of a virtual boson. And that boson is a lattice vibration in a conventional superconductor. Now, here's some questions about high TC. Isn't it amazing that we're asking these questions 20 years after the discovery? It's really startling, but here's a question. Is there a boson interacting with the D-wave quasiparticles? If so, what is its identity? Is it a phonon? Is it a spin density wave? Is it something else? And if you know its identity, is it involved in the Cooper pairing? Three logical sequence questions. Well, here's one candidate. This was put forward by Phil Anderson within the same year as the discovery of high TC. You start with an antiferromagnetic insulator into which you put a few holes. But this insulator retains the correlations between the spins. Look at it this way. They're already paired by the exchange energy. Those pairs become coherent. You get the highest temperature superconductor possible. In some very simplified fashion, that's Anderson's RVB theory of high TC. So here it's a spin interaction, a spin fluctuation, which is making the superconductivity. Well, here's an alternative. Very intense, high-frequency lattice vibrations could, within the traditional theory, pair the electrons and make the superconductivity. This idea was put forward by Alex Müller before Anderson's theory because it was his motivation for finding the high TCs. He argued that the transition metal oxides have giant electron lattice interactions, and they do. So he guessed that they would be high TC superconductors. So for 20 years, there basically has been war between these two camps, to put it kindly. Now, there have been many, many, many studies of electron boson interactions in high temperature superconductivity. It's very clear that there are some bosons interacting with the D-wave quasiparticles. It would take me hours to go through all the work that's in here. So all I did is list some of the key recent results and say that they fall into two categories, people who believe that spin fluctuations are predominant and people who believe that lattice modes are predominant. They should be in there too, but very little thought has been given to that issue. But I think it's very important. Now, one of the key pieces of evidence, in fact, probably the first really incontrovertible one, that there is an electron-boson interaction. Don't read this word here. It says electron-phonon, but there's no direct evidence that this thing is a phonon. It's a boson. This is the dispersion relationship. It's the energy versus momentum for an electron moving through the crystal. At some low energies, it moves through freely. And then at some energy, near 50 millivolts, it suddenly changes its dispersion relationship because it becomes dressed by interactions with whatever the boson is. This is true for almost all high TC superconductors. This happens. A way to demonstrate that this would be a lattice vibration mode would be to do an isotope effect. You just change the mass of the atoms in the mode, so the frequency in the mode would shift by the square root of the ratio of the masses. But photoemission didn't have enough resolution to see the small effects. So the reason why this says an unusual isotope effect is that it's an isotope effect which didn't have enough resolution to answer the question which was being posed. So far, at this point, no definite conclusions. Okay, so we wanted to address this problem using one of these data sets or an enhanced version thereof to look at these features out here at higher energies. Why do we look at those features? Because in conventional tunneling theory, if there is a boson of energy omega, then at energy E, which is delta plus omega, you see a step in the density of states. A step in the IDV is a peak in the next derivative. This is a peak in D2 IDV squared. It's much easier to see. So these peaks in D2 IDV squared can be associated with the phonons which are creating conventional superconductivity, and we wanted to study the same effect, but now in the high TC superconductors. Well, do we have a peak in D2 IDV squared at an energy delta plus omega? Well, the answer is trivially yes. This spectrum has been known for 17 years. It has particle hole symmetric features, which if you took the next derivative are two peaks in D2 IDV squared occurring at the same particle hole symmetric energies. So we do have raw data that has this that could have this information in it. However, we have a terrible problem. The energy of the boson occurs at an absolute energy, which is delta plus omega. But delta is horribly disordered. So no conventional technique can extract the value of omega from this environment. The only way to do it is to know the energy of the peak in D2 IDV squared and delta at every location in this field of view. So Jin-Ho Lee set out to do that. One of the reasons why we built this very complex lab is not to measure the IDV in 12 hours, although that makes the graduate student's life much easier. It's to measure D2 IDV squared. Measuring the next derivative of any physical observable is much harder to do, so we can make a complete map of D2 IDV squared in this facility in about 1 month. So here's a map. It contains the electron-boson interaction and probably the mechanism of high TC in it. Just watch it go by and see if you can figure out the mechanism. Okay, I'll explain how we analyze this data set now. So let me just say, this is the first spatial map of inelastic processes of electron-boson interactions in a solid with atomic resolution. Okay, so we have the spectrum at every location. So everywhere we know delta, and the point here of maximum slope in DIDV is the peak in D2 IDV squared. So we can label this energy as delta, and we can label that energy as omega. And we can do that for every spectrum. So I take first I subtract delta, and then I take the next derivative, D2 IDV squared. Now as a function of energy minus the local value of delta. So this is the value of omega. You see it's about 53 millivolts. And we know that value. It's the energy of this peak everywhere in every field of view. And it is particle hole symmetric. The peaks occur at the same energies on both sides. So here's one of our pictures of where the atoms are. Here's a picture of the pair energy as a function of location. Here's a picture of the boson energy as a function of location. That means the value of this energy mapped with atomic resolution simultaneously with the pair energy. Okay, how many people think that the pair energy is correlated with the boson energy?
Yes.
You're dead right. They're well correlated. They're well correlated with each other. I would have still said. So we've been struggling with this, but statistically these things are always well correlated with each other. When the boson energy is low, the pair energy is high, and vice versa. Those of you who know weak coupling BCS know that this contradicts weak coupling BCS, but it does not contradict strong coupling BCS. This can easily happen in strong coupling. Okay, so now we wanted to study these phenomena as a function of doping. So here's my pair energy at low doping. It's some very high gap energy near 60 millivolts, higher doping. You see that the energy of the mean energy of the pairing is moving from 60 down to 30 down to below 20. Now let's look at the boson energy. Blue-green scale here is from 35 to 65 millivolts. Blue-green, blue-green. Just looking at the raw data, you see that these guys changed rapidly and these guys didn't really change their color scheme. Statistically, we did 5 different dopings, and for each doping we measured the pairing energy. It's a distribution because it's disordered. But clearly the pairing energy goes from low at high doping to high at low doping, consistent with many other probes. But now we also measured the boson energy at those 5 dopings. There it is. It does not change. It's completely rigid as a function of doping.
You mentioned that there's anti-correlation.
Yeah. Statistically, it's easy for both things to happen. I'll explain to you tomorrow if you like. There's an axis upon which you can slide the distribution, which makes this possible. So here's the situation we were in as of a few months ago. We have something that we think is a boson involved in the D-wave quasiparticles. It's disordered, but it's strongly correlated. The boson energy is correlated with the gap energy. But it doesn't change with doping. So the obvious question is this: a lattice vibration mode, the lattice frequencies would not change with doping. They're just a property of the crystal. So to address that question, we did the world's first isotope substitution, inelastic spectroscopic imaging STM experiment. So this is a crystal where all the oxygen is oxygen 16, and this is a crystal where all the oxygen is oxygen 18. I won't torture you. Oxygen 18, pair energy, boson energy. Oxygen 16, pair energy, boson energy. These are simultaneous. These are simultaneous. So here's the oxygen 16 data. The mean boson energy is here near about 52 millivolts. If we change the mass of the oxygen atoms from oxygen 16 to oxygen 18, we make the mass on the spring heavier, so we drive the frequency down, which is exactly what happened. And if I show you the statistics, the mean mode energy for oxygen 16 was here near 52 point something, and for oxygen 18 was lower, down by 3.7 millivolts, which is very close to 1 minus the square root of 16 over 18. So this is a priori evidence that the oxygen mass is involved in this main boson. These guys, despite their long history of having had no legitimate identification, we now know that they are lattice vibration modes. However, some of our very good colleagues made a proposal that this is all technically correct, but it's irrelevant. And the proposal is that we happen to excite an irrelevant oxygen vibration mode in the barrier. That's a traditional inelastic tunneling process. This is a perfectly logical hypothesis. There's nothing wrong with it, and a very good question. However, we now know that this proposal is not correct. And here's how we know. This data I received last night from Japan. This is a photo emission study of the same crystals that we studied. So this is the dispersion relationship, energy versus momentum for electrons moving through those crystals. The energy momentum curve for oxygen 16 and for oxygen 18. If we plot a straight line and subtract, we find that there are two very different curves for departures from the linear dispersion. One curve is for oxygen 16 and the other curve is for oxygen 18, and they are shifted from each other by 3 millivolts. Here's the spectroscopic STM data, which we published in August, and here's the high-precision photoemission study, which is in excellent agreement, and it's carried out by our collaborators in Japan, Hiroshi Esaki. So the important conclusion here, and then I'll let you go, is that these features are due to lattice vibrations. And these famous features are due to lattice vibrations. And the lattice vibration frequency is correlated with the superconducting energy gap. Very tightly so. Now, does this prove that the lattice vibration is involved in the mechanism? Well, we don't know. There will be, I'm sure, a long, drawn-out fight over these results. But it's a practical step forward. Things which were not understood for the last 10 years now are understood. Okay, let me just make one comment about the future of this technique. Spectroscopic imaging, STM, is a different way of doing condensed matter physics. Instead of making a material and then spending 10 years measuring the heat capacity, etc., you can go directly and find out what does the electronic structure look like and what does each perturbation do to it. Dopant atom, random scattering, vortex core, etc. And you can do it in a wide variety of different ways. Electron lattice, dopant atoms, etc. These are very powerful and flexible techniques, and we very much hope that they will become a key tool in advanced condensed matter physics from now on. And to my colleagues, I wish to say a very special thank you. Without them, none of this could have been done. Thank you all for your time and attention. So in YBCO, they're more ordered. TC isn't any higher, but the materials properties are better. The dopant atoms do bad things to some degrees of freedom, but with respect to the fundamental idea of making the pairs, I don't think they may play a little bit of a spoiler or destructive role. I don't think they play a central role to making the pairs.
Your technique is a surface technique.
Yeah. So cuprates are layered materials. The anisotropy is several thousand between the in-plane properties and the out-of-plane properties. So the top surface layer of a cuprate is the bulk.
Can you have you applied this method to other materials?
Yes. Conductors? Yes, we have used them in conventional superconductors like niobium diselenide for test experiments. But in advanced materials, we have been studying the manganites and the ruthenates and making good progress in those two areas.
I have a very nasty material in mind. Ice.
Ice? So ice is an insulator. So these... Okay, conducting ice one could use.
It's a matter of...
Yeah, okay. Okay.
That's why it's so interesting.
Yeah. As long as they're marginally conducting, you can use these techniques. Yeah.
Like what about heavy fermion systems where it's supposed to be EP wave?
So we have a paper on the web about strontium ruthenate 214 where the techniques worked just fine. The 214 was interesting, but it wasn't startling.
In particular, did you find any boson load that gets?
No. I don't think, the gap is only 350 microvolts. So the scale upon which you have to do that experiment is very, very much finer. But, one thing we're going to do with respect to this feature, now we're getting another round of technically correct but irrelevant. And so now we're going to do this again in a different cuprate where we have access to the D-wave gap.
Are there any other boson candidates in your data?
Oh, gosh. Yes. Good question. This is either twice that. The likeliest thing is that that's 2 omega of the same boson, but we couldn't prove it. It may indeed be an independent boson which is involved in the mechanism. And down here, it's not impossible that there are bosons down here too, but we have too much spatial disorder to get them out. So obviously, we studied the biggest one. No. logically, to do that experiment, you have to do the equivalent of an isotope effect, which means that you would dial J, or the spectrum of spin density waves, by changing the isotopes.
Right, but your isotope experiment would show that it was a phonon, a lattice phonon.
Okay, but the traditional, Ashcroft and Merman, if I dare use those words, view of solid state physics, where you can separate all of the bosonic elementary excitations into well-defined channels. This is a phonon, this is a spin density wave. That may not actually hold true for strong coupling in the transition metal oxides. It may be that every phonon changes J as it goes by and therefore entangles the spin degree of freedom. So what we show here is that the lattice mode is definitely coupled to the D-wave quasiparticles. So the next step remains to be done.
You showed fantastic experiments here. How much did it cost?
No comment. I'm not allowed to answer that question. Cornell University. Yeah. Say again, please. That's a good question. So we designed the cryostats ourselves. The boil rate, even for one of these big cryostats, is below 2.5 liters a day. So so the vibrational spectrum is down one or two orders of magnitude from your typical helium doer. And then the rigidity of the apparatus is such that the drive from the turbulent boiling noise at low frequencies is not enough to move the tip by more than a femtometer. That took a lot of engineering. Thank you for that question.
Quick question, one last quick question. Yeah. Is there any relation between this boson mode and resonance modes in
neutron scattering? This is a Canadian question.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Okay, so there are spin density wave modes whose energy is near this energy. So it's not impossible to imagine that those spin density waves are entangled with these vibrational modes. But the traditional tools of solid state physics are not designed to answer a question like that. So we're really struggling to identify an experiment which would identify, let's say, the quantum numbers of the boson. Is it spin one and a lattice vibration mode, et cetera, et cetera. The experiment necessary doesn't yet exist.
At very low doping, they seem to see that resonance
mode
goes at very low energy.
Yeah.
Does yours do?
Oh, no, it's independent of completely independent of energy.
Yeah, the sort of related thing was magnetic field. I guess like an in-plane field or something could.
Yes, an in-plane field is a great idea.
Destroy the resonance.
Yeah. Yeah, that would cost about $2 million.